This week on the show, news in 140 characters or less. Get your video resume ready to go. And don't forget, people, the ads pay the bills. All this on This Week in Media, episode 139. Hey there, boys and girls. We are back on a Monday with This Week in Media. I'm your host, Daisy Whitney, host of the New Media Minute and writer and reporter for various online and TV and print outlets, multimedia reporter, all that jazz. You can find me at daisywhitney.com. And today we are streaming live on Leo Laporte's Twit TV. So to all our live friends, thank you for tuning in, as always. To all of you who listen throughout the week on your iPods, on your computers, we are, as always, glad to have you listening. Alex is on a shoot today in Texas, deep in the heart of Texas. So he should be back next week. And I believe we were not on last week. So sorry for those of you who missed us. I had to be in New York for business at a conference. And, you know, sometimes that happens, so thank you for sticking with us and tuning back in. I have a fabulous guest lineup today. I have some of our semi-regulars, and I have some new, fresh blood. So for our semi-regulars, Tim Street with Ape Digital, executive producer. Tim heads up French Made TV and also Ape Digital, which is involved in a lot of exciting brand-centric web projects. Thank you for being on the show, as always. Tim, how are you?
Doing well, Daisy. Always nice to be on the show with you. How are you doing?
I am excellent because it is nice and toasty in the Petaluma offices, and that's the way I like it, kids.
Sweat lodge.
I'm not an AC person, you know, so that's one of the things I like about here. Just give me some fans, you know, and I don't even need fans most of the time. I just like it hot.
So,
and I don't mean that in a dirty way, okay?
Texas? Do you think it's hot in Texas where Alex is shooting? What's he shooting, by the way?
I don't know. He has a lot of top secret projects. He doesn't tell me things.
Top secret. That's
you know,
good.
Most projects are top secret. I mean, the truth is, like, I don't reveal who all of my clients are because you got to keep some things top secret because you don't want the competition stealing your business. No, seriously, it's actually a slightly interesting point. But I do think for entrepreneurs out there, you know, it's good to find a balance in terms of what you disclose and the clients that you don't disclose. Because, you know, like I said, you got to protect what side your bread is buttered on. Let me introduce our other guest, David Rewalt, hailing from the baby's room, the soon-to-be baby's room in his home office in San Francisco. How are you, David?
I am doing well. I'm happy to be home this weekend.
David is sort of our marketing, branding expert, and you are working on a number of interesting projects, none of which you can talk about, which is fine. We appreciate that, but you also are going to be a dad soon, and since yesterday was Father's Day, happy, you know, bun in the oven Father's Day to you.
Thank you. Very exciting. We're due in September.
All right. Very cool. Very cool. I hope the summer goes well and your wife endures the San Francisco chill. And from Los Angeles, first time guest, Brady Brim DeForest. You know, Brady, I keep wanting to say Brady DeBrim Forest or whatever. I'm sure I'm not the first person who is tempted to butcher your name, but I had to look down at my notes to pronounce it correctly and make sure I got it. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us. Brady is one of the editors and founders, is that fair to say, of TubeFilter.tv?
You got it.
Yeah, and TubeFilter is a site. Well, I'll let you describe it. TubeFilter is all about web entertainment.
Absolutely, yeah. We're the leading authority on online entertainment. We co-founded the Streamy Awards, and we religiously cover the web television space. So, any web series news out there, we're usually the first ones on it.
Fabulous.
We're doing our job right.
And I actually did my very first story for TubeFilter.tv last week, so I'll be doing a little stringing, if you will.
Good.
For TubeFilter.tv, because my goal is to be ubiquitous. So let's get into the news. We would be remiss if we didn't start with sort of what's been the biggest news in the last week, obviously an evolving story that involves new media in a very interesting way, and that is that's the elections in Iran and the subsequent protests and so on. And I think it's really that's really demonstrated the role that the T word, Twitter, you know, we got to talk about it because Twitter is just more than mainstream now. It's playing a very significant role in terms of how people are communicating. So I think a lot of our listeners are probably familiar with how the people on the ground were able to use Twitter. So I'm going to ask you just to very briefly touch on that, but more so to kind of just keep us up to date with what the latest is in that story, and then more so kind of its significance and what this says. So you have been following it very closely for TubeFilter and other places. So I'm going to toss off to you, Brady. Go right ahead.
Excellent. Yeah, well, I think it's a very fascinating phenomenon. Two Fridays ago, after the news broke in Iran that there had been some discrepancies in the vote counting after the presidential election, there was about 24 hours of radio silence on behalf of CNN and other major media outlets. And the American public and really the world needed to find an alternative source of information. And Twitter really stepped into the spotlight in a way that it never had before. And it delivered real-time updates from the ground in Tehran, despite the attempts by the Iranian government to block outbound traffic and to perform deep packet inspection on the communications that were going out of the country. But what was really fascinating to me was the groundswell of support that the protests in Iran experienced on behalf of the Western world vis-a-vis social media. So whether it was Facebook or Twitter or even YouTube, where you know, thousands of hours of footage have been uploaded live from the streets of Iran and Tehran, social media has played a really, really significant role. And you have non-traditional news outlets like Huffington Post that have really stepped up and took over, I think, you know, assumed the mantelpiece from outlets like CNN to provide a totally different level of coverage because of Twitter and because of live blogging and the ability to really kind of roll with the punches, if you will. When an update comes in, Nico over at Huffington Post was able to put it up immediately. I think maybe
what sort of update? Do you mean just as an interesting tweet came across, or give us sort of a specific example of what the Huffington Post did versus what a traditional news outlet did?
Absolutely. Well, I think the advantage, one, is their speed and also their flexibility. And what they were able to do is take, you know, for instance, information that was being provided to the Iranian public, for instance, proxy servers that allowed them to get around government filters. The Huffington Post was publishing proxy servers. They were literally taking, you know, emails coming in from sources on the ground and publishing those. They were publishing YouTube videos, but they did it in a way that it didn't necessarily have to be a fully crafted story. It was literally like updates, similar to like a way a Tumblr or you know, or Twitter itself even works. Just micro kind of status updates as soon as information came in. They didn't necessarily wait to create a full form or full fledged story, but instead just provided updates to an ongoing narrative.
Now, Brady, you were involved in that a little bit more than just a passive observer, weren't you? Weren't you doing some hands-on work here as well?
Absolutely, yeah. I think personally, I mean, I have an academic background in foreign relations, and so it's a topic area that I'm very passionate about. And when I saw the kind of interaction happening vis-a-vis Twitter, both my curiosity and my compassion were completely piqued, and I literally spent that first weekend, both Saturday and Sunday, constantly updating my own Twitter feed to help raise awareness. Went out to Westwood and joined in the LA-based protests for an hour. But honestly, I couldn't leave my computer. I was literally addicted to the process because I felt like I was actually interacting and making a difference in news that was happening around the globe, literally. I also have a couple of close friends who are on the ground in Tehran, and because of that, I was able to coordinate with them to help get certain pieces of information out via Twitter to the Huffington Post. And that was a very mind-opening experience because I could sense how social media had suddenly taken over for mainstream media outlets. What CNN did in Tiananmen Square in 89, Twitter was doing in 2009 for Iran.
And what's interesting is there was a CNET story, kind of to your point, that talked about how mainstream media outlets dropped the ball and really weren't reporting on it for a significant period of time while it was being reported on social media outlets. But I guess the skeptic in me, as much as I think this represents a big shift in how Twitter is used, a big shift in its perception, it's sort of one of those seminal moments, if you will, in the news business, but also in the intersection of news and society, news and sort of user interaction and viewer interaction. I guess I have to say the skeptic of me wonders if it makes a difference. I don't think anything has necessarily changed in Iran. And you know what? Maybe that's not the point. But I guess what I have to, because it hasn't, I have to ask the question is, what is the takeaway and how does the accessibility and the means by which ordinary citizens on the ground in foreign countries can, you know, get news out? How does this sort of change, I don't know, society, culture?
I think there are a few society changes that have happened with this particular story. I mean, like you, there are a lot of skeptics out there. I was listening to Christopher Penn and John Wall on Marketing Over Coffee, and they were kind of laughing about how there's a lot of people on Twitter that have changed their avatars to green, and they don't think that's going to do anything. But I disagree. This is the first time that you've seen a group of Americans get involved and do something, even though it's something as little as changing their avatar to a green avatar, but yet they're doing something to make a political statement. And in turn, if anyone in Iran can see that, they know that there are American people that are wishing freedom for them. And I think that's a big social change, is that, you know, Obama said the world is watching, and they are. And a lot of the world was watching on Twitter.
And, you know, good point, Tim, is that change, it's all, I think it's always important to remember, you know, whether it's political, social, or just personal in our own careers, it's not going to happen overnight. So I don't think, you know, even though we might not necessarily have seen any immediate on-the-ground change for the Iranian people or in the political system, but maybe the worldwide openness of this via social media does start to change. I'm certainly by no means even pretending to be a foreign relations expert, but maybe it starts to change perception, and over time that starts to change reality in those different countries. Interesting. I think that there was an interesting report last week, and you know what, I think I bet this report was done before the Iranian election, but there was a study by Zugby Interactive, which sort of regularly follows how we consume news and whatnot, and not surprisingly, I mean, this is sort of a I'm shocked. The internet is by far the most popular source of information and the preferred choice for news, ahead of television, newspapers, and radio, according to a new poll. I think, you know, that's really not even worth discussing, because that's something we'd all certainly expect. More than half of people questioned the survey said they'd select the internet if they had to choose only one news source, followed by 21% for television and 10% for both newspapers and radio. Oh, the poor newspaper business. But what I think is interesting is only 10% describe social websites as important for news, and only 4% would go to them for information. And I think, and again, I suspect this study was done well before last week's news. Do you think that, and this is going to be hypothetical, if a study like this were done, you know, this week or next week, and I'll throw this to David so we can bring him into the conversation, do you think that there would be a significant rise in the number of people who say that they now turn to social media services for information, i.e. has this changed the perception of Twitter as a news source?
I think incrementally it probably has, no question about it. It's raised the awareness about Twitter quite a bit, and is sort of that instantaneous news source. You know, kind of what I find exciting about this is the first step in what I think will be many steps in this sort of real-time reporting. I mean, think about for a second, you know, the onset of Google Wave coming this fall, and now this ability to have multiple people collaborating at the same time in real time on a story and publishing it, you know, all over the web. So I think that if anything, it's turned people on to the fact that, you know, they're going to be having access to real-time data, real-time news. They don't have to wait for the networks so much to get their information. It's going to be instant. And to me, that's kind of the beauty of why people flock to the internet for news, is because they don't want to wait for a produced piece, you know, that's on at 11 at night. They want it now. They want it when it's happening. And this really way,
yeah,
I think, it,
the,
you know?
There's a problem there, though. There's a problem there in accuracy. You know, do you want it fast or do you want it right? And a lot of times what's happening now is there are stories that get – they're broken on Twitter, and they're broken stories because they're wrong. So that's something that we have to be careful about. I mean, the stuff that has the nuances that have developed in journalism over the last 50 years to add some journalistic integrity don't necessarily exist on Twitter.
And, you know, I don't know that that's going to change. As people become more involved and become sort of, it's, I mean, Alex is, you know, certainly talks about this a lot. I think it's becoming more incumbent on citizens and ourselves to fact check and to use, you know, and maybe in Twitter, I think becomes, and social media becomes sort of, hey, did you hear this? You know, a gossip, a water cooler thing, where you then go and you sort of verify it on other sites that might have, you know, higher standards and best practices and sourcing requirements. But I don't see that the greater involvement of everyday people and so-called citizen journalists in producing news, whether it's news that's a 140-character tweet or whether it's their own video, is necessarily going to, I don't think they're necessarily going to subscribe to the same journalistic standards that a New York Times has or that a CNN has. So I think the upshot is it's you know, every man and woman for himself to figure out what's actually true, you know, to take what's said on Twitter as a tip-off, to go to Google News, to go to other places and see if that's accurate. What do you think, David?
Well, you know, Tim, I agree with you. You know, what is the filtering mechanism? What is the policing mechanism in place? You know, Daisy, nobody has the wherewithal to be objective, quote unquote, like the New York Times reporters or, you know, trained journalists. It's curious, is, you know, will the average citizen be able to fact check? Will they care about it? Or they will just react emotionally? I mean, I don't know. I don't want to give the general public as much credit as you might there.
Right. No, I know. And I'm not sure that people will, which I think is, you know, maybe what's unfortunate. But then at the same time, I think it's also to some degree a bit of a reality. Did you guys see, it was about a week and a half ago, the Daily Show piece by Jason Jones. Oh, my God. It was so brilliant. This five and a half minute piece that he did where he went into the New York Times headquarters and interviewed various editors. It was just, he had these great...
I did see it. It was great.
Wasn't that brilliant?
Yeah, it was funny. It was really good.
It got circulated a lot on the internet. For any of our listeners who haven't seen it, just at reply to me on Twitter, and I'll link it up later today and show it to you, because I just thought it was brilliant. I mean, he just did an incredibly hilarious and sadly accurate, for those of us in the journalism business, report on kind of how newspapers are really old school and antiquated. At one point, he's sitting down with one of the editors at the New York Times, and he has the paper, and he says, so basically, is there anything in here that happened today? And this is all yesterday's news. And the guy is sort of, he said something to the effect of, well, it's not all stuff that happened yesterday. And Jason Jones goes, so you mean it happened even longer ago than yesterday, but there's nothing actually in here that happened today. And, you know, and then he has this funny, hilarious end quote where he says, what's black and white and red all over? And I won't tell you the answer because I'm not going to be a spoiler person, but it's hilarious and you should watch the video to get his answer. Even though it's comedy, a parody, obviously one of the things that The Daily Show does that's, look at Colleen, she's fabulous. She's, I know, isn't that brilliant? He picks up the phone, he picks up a landline phone. He's like, hi, I'm calling from 1965. What is this? Who uses these? But it's like many things on The Daily Show, it's really some of the truest and most spot on reporting on what is actually going on in society. So how journalism is changing is obviously an ongoing story that we will continue to cover on TWIM throughout the year and throughout the years as it changes. Another thing that I saw a story on in the Wall Street Journal late last week that I think is worth us touching base on is something that also has been going on for a while and probably will continue to be an ongoing story. And that is that a number of states are considering taxes on online retailers. And the story said Amazon threatens cuts over state taxes. The story said that North Carolina is close to passing a law that would force online retailers to collect the state's 4.5% sales tax from marketing affiliates. People get a sales commission from online customer referrals. And I don't think this is anything that Amazon is happy with. But this is something Amazon is not, North Carolina is not the first state that is considering this. New York already looked into this and I believe passed a tax already. California has considered it. Hawaii is said to be weighing a similar measure. Connecticut has looked into assessing taxes on internet sales. And, you know, obviously everybody is hurting during the recession and certainly states are falling short on their budgets and looking for ways to make up for it. And this seems to be a way that they can collect some revenue. Actually, really interesting point. A study released in April by University of Tennessee said that uncollected internet sales taxes will cost state and local governments more than $11 billion by the year 2012. So by not assessing state taxes, that's what they're potentially losing. You know, David, I know you're close to the publishing business, and this is not just a publishing story. But what is your take? Is this the beginning of a movement in which eventually all of our purchases on Amazon will be taxed and other retailers as well?
Well, I think it's going to be a long battle with a lot of states and a lot of big players. I mean, you know, clearly Amazon is going to probably hurt North Carolina just as much as they would help themselves by putting this tax in place, by killing all their affiliate programs in the state, distribution in the state, all those kinds of things. So, you know, they're pushing right back, and I, you know, unfortunately, in the economic times we're in, you know, it's North Carolina's reaction and lots of other states to say, we got to figure out yet another revenue stream, you know, and this is what they come up with. Yet I don't think they anticipated the pushback that some of the big players like Amazon are giving them, and I think that Amazon's just the beginning of a lot of other big players, you know, like an iTunes store and other ones pushing back to say, no, this is not going to work.
So who pushes back on who? So Amazon is pushing back on the state government. And then what about the retailers, sort of the marketing affiliates in North Carolina and other states? Are they then pushing back and saying, no, this would hurt us? I mean, is it just the states that want this to happen?
It's state government, again, looking for revenue streams. You know, I mean, look at California. We're hurting big time in California, and they're selling off landmarks, it's so bad. But
California, there's a chance that it may come up again in California as well. I just got some emails from, I think, LinkShare and Commission Junction, which are affiliate marketing type programs, and they're talking about you know, how this is a problem and we need to notify our senators and our congressmen about it. And it if you step back from it for a second and think about just the record industry and how there used to be a lot of record stores out there that were paying local taxes that aren't paying taxes anymore. They're paying for fire departments, by the way. And that money's not there. The state's not getting money from Towered Records or Blockbuster video stores.
I think it's a tough situation because sometimes I just look at this as a consumer and I think, well, one of the beauties of shopping on an Amazon is not having to pay that. But of course, you know, many of us on this show, many of our listeners, you know, we wear many hats. We're consumers, but we're also business people, whether we're doing business on Amazon or whether we're selling something on iTunes or whatever it is. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about this is my point. Brady, what do you think?
Well, I think that the sales tax in and of itself, you know, in my opinion, is a great alternative to an income tax. I think that there needs to be some major tax reform, however. That's a different conversation. But I think, you know, what they've done in Europe, and this is universal for their online business as well as their brick-and-mortar businesses, is implemented a value-added tax. Which I think actually decreases the sticker shock associated with getting dinged with the tax at the end of your checkout process. When it's that allows the consumer to kind of forget that they're even paying tax. That isn't necessarily the situation though right now. I think you have online retailers who have not had to pay state sales tax for so long, and their margins reflect that, and they've optimized their businesses with that in mind. Obviously, they know that there will be, I believe, change at some point down the road, but of course they're going to push back. If you look at the affiliate program in North Carolina, Amazon's affiliate program, that's like $6 million of lost income that's dispersed in that state that no longer will be taxed on an income basis either. So there's definitely going to be change, whether or not it is going to be, kind of a push and pull all the way to the finish, or if there's going to be some kind of agreement that's reached, I'm not sure, but we're definitely coming to a crossroads, because so much commerce happens online, and that trend is obviously increasing. Like you said, by 2012, I mean, that's $11 billion in taxes that states aren't collecting, and that's going to have to change.
So down with income tax, up with sales tax. Hey, Brady, while I have you on the show, I want to ask you, what is, do you care to share any tips on sort of the hottest new web series, since that's what TubeFilter is all about? Any shows that you've seen lately that really kind of blow you away and that you think our listeners should check out?
Absolutely. Well, this is kind of the opposite of a new show. It's more like going back into the depths of web television. I recently got hooked on Icebox again. For those of you who don't know, Icebox was a startup that popped up on the scene in 99, and similar to kind of a Strike TV model, they had tons of Hollywood writers, folks from Futurama, The Simpsons, South Park, that wrote, directed, and produced animated series, and one in particular, Starship Regulars, I started watching again over the weekend, and it's just unbelievable. So if you get a chance, go check it out. Icebox is still around. Version 2.0 is kind of a slimmed down version of their previous incarnation, but it's kind of fun to go back and rediscover, Generation 1 web television sometimes. So that would be my recommendation for the week.
What's the URL? Is that icebox.com?
It's icebox.com.
See, nice and easy. Speaking of web videos, our dear friend and fellow Twitter, Martin Sargent, is searching for a job. And I don't know if you guys have seen this video. I know David has. It's a really good job.com. That is the website, but make sure you spell it good with an E. And there's basically a winery that's kind of looking for a social media correspondent, and Martin did a video, and it's very funny. I love Martin Sargent.
I'm actually in one of those videos, Daisy. My next door neighbor, Carolyn Scott, did one as well.
Oh, really? Okay, so you have to link that up. I have to check that out too. Oh, I see. Colleen is playing it. I think there are a couple interesting points of discussion here with this. One thing that impresses me is just the winery is offering a $10,000 a month salary for a 6-month job, which is, I think, really fantastic and wonderful. Obviously, from a financial point of view, it's also interesting to see a brand, a company, making such a big bet and sort of upfront, if you will, commitment, saying, okay, we're willing to spend this much money, and that's just the salary for whoever wins this contest. Obviously, there'll be production costs and whatnot and marketing associated with it. But to use, whoever this person is as kind of a brand ambassador online to get the name out. David, we were chatting about this, and you said, it'd be interesting to kind of bring up the next generation resume and what that might look like. How does this, is this just for people like Martin who are personalities, who are hosts, or how do you see kind of what a really good job is doing and what Martin is doing as, I don't know, maybe being a template or something for job searches of the future, or really even job searches over the next several months, because a lot of people out there are looking.
I would love to see lots of companies do this. I think this would be awesome. Just they have so many candidates right now and so many people out of work. I mean, why not force people to be creative in how they present themselves, and you know, especially if it's for a tech job or anything that's like marketing, especially marketing jobs. I mean, good Lord, if you can't make a fun video with yourself, you shouldn't be doing their marketing for them. And you know, Martin's video just cracked me up, and it was fun, it was cool, and you know, I mean, talk about making the HR job fun, getting to watch these all day. I mean, I just, it's neat. I mean, but it does bring up an interesting point, is, you know, when you do your resume now, it's no longer just a two-page piece of paper that you hope gets in the right hands. You know, I think you need to extend it. It needs to be, you know, a clickable online experience for people to learn more about your work. And it's hard to put, you know, in today's world, you know, everything you need to put in two pages. I think that's the beginning document and sort of the table of contents, or even the outline for your web page or website.
See, now this is where I would disagree with you, and this is okay. Kind of the writer in me. I do agree that I think most people could probably benefit by having some kind of video or interactivity in their resumes. But in terms of the length of it, now I think this is from, you know, being a professional journalist for 12 years and being edited for 12 years and being forced to condense things for 12 years. And granted, I'm not really in a position to do a lot of hiring. I sort of run a one-woman show. But it would make me crazy to read a resume that was more than 2 pages. And I would think, you know what, dude, learn to condense it. That's what I have to do every day of my life in stories. Well, I have to figure out how to tell a story.
I'm not saying make the resume longer than 2 pages. I'm saying that in addition to your standard size condensed resume, there's this sort of reference, you know, website that people can look more in depth if and when they want to learn more about you and your work experience, and they want to take those 3 bullet points they saw and that interested them on your resume and you know dig into it deeper.
Oh, so that you Absolutely. That you almost are having like an interactive resume as well. Tim,
right,
go ahead.
Right.
I know you've got some thoughts on this.
You know, the interesting thing that the wine company's doing here is not only are they getting people to make video resumes, but they're leveraging those people's social networks. I mean, I haven't looked lately, but I imagine Martin has like 5,000 or 9,000 followers on Twitter.
Oh, he's
that's
15.
A good amount of people. He has 15,000, so there, you know. And Carolyn Scott, my next-door neighbor, she did one as well. And, you know, she's got 2,000 followers on Twitter. So they're leveraging these targeted with Martin, and Carolyn are great examples because Martin is really tapped into the online video world, and Carolyn is tapped into the vegan and the veggie world. She has a website called Healthy Voyager, which is about eating healthy while you're on vacation. And so this wine company, they find a few people like that. They've tapped into this ready-to-go audience that fits their niche, and they're in good shape.
And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think that the way that you know, the advertising world works vis-a-vis traditional celebrities, what you're doing is you're actually paying, or you're actually purchasing the audience that comes along with a name. And in this case, we're dealing with micro-celebrity, you know, people who have a following in a specific niche. And so the cost, you know, especially in this case with a really good job, $10,000 a month, they're really paying to leverage their candidate's following. And I think that's incredibly valuable. It's something that you know, compared to a traditional route, is actually very affordable. And that's why in this case a resume doesn't matter, because it's not about what you have on paper. It's about your personality. It's about how you engage with your community. And it's about how many followers you have and the quality of those followers.
Well, I think everybody has to bring their own platform to the table. I know certainly when I talk to news outlets or whoever it is, you know, one of the things that I promote is, okay, I've got, you know, I'm active on social networking forums. I host TWIM and so on and so forth. I do the New Media Minute. And those are selling points, but I think we should all look for that. I think whether you are an independent producer and, you know, you have your own podcast or whatever it is, it's all about building your own brand, because nobody's going to do it for you anymore. I mean, if we didn't know that before the
Absolutely.
Recession, I hope we all know that now, certainly because of it, that it is, you know, I definitely believe that it's a dog-eat-dog world, and every man and woman for himself, as I said earlier. But, you know, you kind of have to do that heavy lifting and build that up yourself, whether it's by being really active at the appropriate like-minded industry conferences by positioning yourself as a speaker. I mean, I certainly talked to a lot of folks who are kind of rising thought leaders in social media and online video, and you know, ask me for advice. Okay, how do I get on more panels? And you know, that's certainly a good way to build your profile, build your following, whatever it is. But I think that you're right. Sort of, if you're going to be applying for a job, a gig, a contract that somehow is in the new media space, whether you're going to be on air like a Martin, whether you're going to be producing or whatever it is, I think it's increasingly important not just to have your own platform, but also, David, as you said, you know, this is not just something that works for this type of on-air job, that if you can't find a way to creatively promote yourself, you shouldn't be doing what you're doing, which is kind of funny. I mean, it's something that I say when I'm doing a panel for a conference or whatever. I mean, I say to the executives on it, I'm like, look, people, we don't have to do a conference call, because if you don't know what to say or how to answer questions, then you shouldn't be on it. And obviously the point being that they clearly do, that they've been invited to be on a panel for that reason. So let's segue into another story. David, you sent me an interesting one from CNET by Rafe Needleman, who is an excellent writer, and I like his work. And he talked about 3D means new rules for directors. And this is a little bit more in your wheelhouse than mine, so I'm not even going to do the intro. I'm going to throw this to you, and you can be me for a few minutes.
Well, actually, I'm hoping for help from everybody on this one. I just found it to be an interesting story for a couple of reasons. So, I mean, it seems to me that every couple of years, 3D kind of comes into the picture with, you know, some of the major releases doing a 3D thing. And then it goes away for a few years and it comes back. And it seems to be back now with Up and some of the other 3D releases. But the interesting thing about the article here is that they say that the technology is at a point now that is completely different than the 3D we sort of have given a stigma about, you know, the old sort of 50s 3D persona that it has, and that it's actually changing in a more subtle way, that, you know, it's not just some big knife coming at you out of the screen. It's a lot of these subtle little directorial changes that, you know, make the story more immersive and feel like you're more a part of it than just, you know, some effect that scares you and makes you pop out of your chair. And I found that kind of interesting. And then the other piece I'll say, and then I'll open it up for everyone to sort of discuss, is, you know, how does this translate to, you know, is it the industry trying to, I guess, innovate in a sense to bring more people to the theaters? Is it just a gimmick, or is this actually sort of a way to say, hey, you know, our theater dollars are somewhat dying, and if we do this and we do it right and we put some more infrastructure behind it, you know, are we going to see, you know, the industry pick up in terms of theater attendance?
And what was Rafe's take? Is it a gimmick, or is it something that again is becoming a critical part of the storytelling?
Well, you know, his point was really about how there are some innovators out there who are attempting to bring it into more of the storytelling mode and get it out of that persona that it has now in the general public, which is, oh, it's 3D, it's just a gimmick, it's just, you know, it's not really, I don't really care if it's in 3D. You know, once I get the DVD home or I'm, you know, downloading it, that's, I'm not going to experience that at home anyway. This, they say, is something that is, you know, hopefully there's two or three companies out there that are saying, hey, you know what, we're really actually innovating the way the movie experience goes now. And, you know, if you see the reviews on, like, the 3D for Up and Caroline and some of the other ones, I mean, people are saying really, really good things about those movies, and that you know, it wasn't really just a set of effects for them to enjoy as much as it was just something that accented and helped the story along. So I'd be interested to see what everybody thinks of that.
Well, Tim, you're kind of our storytelling expert. I know that's your passion point when it comes to making videos. So what do you think? Does 3D enhance storytelling, and what are some of the ways it can do that?
Well, I actually used to work in a 3D movie theater. I worked at the Magic Eye Theater at Epcot, and was there during Magic Journeys and Captain EO. And
very cool.
When I came to L.A., there was a screenwriting guru that I kind of started following, a guy named Robert McKee. He has a book called Story, and he lectures a lot about story. And one of the principles of Robert McKee's book is that whenever there's a technological advance in entertainment, spectacle comes first, then story. If you look at filmmaking, first there were the Lumiere brothers, and a train pulled into a station, and people ran out of the theater screaming with that novelty. They were emotionally connected to it. They thought they were going to get hit by the train. They didn't understand the technology. But 8 years later, we had the Great Train Robbery that actually used filmmaking as a storytelling device. Just like with sound, the same thing happened with sound. It was a novelty at first, and then it became mainstream. It became part of filmmaking. Same thing with special effects. You know, it took a while for us to get to Star Wars or to get to Terminator 2. And the same thing with 3D. You know, it started out as a novelty, and it wasn't until great films like Jaws 3D that we actually had good stories. I'm kidding. But now I think there's something else going on here. Right now, with storytelling, the 3D is now becoming or is now using more story, especially when you look it up. But in addition to that, I think piracy is really driving this. And, you know, it, just like television, when television came along, the theaters had to reinvent themselves, and the motion picture industry had to reinvent itself. And I think that's what's going on right now. It's combating piracy and the internet as an entertainment device. So
now
they've got to do something.
3D was actually – I'm sorry. Go ahead, David.
Oh, I was just going to ask a question, Tim. So the piracy thing, and this is really interesting to me, is – so does that mean it's sort of hard for them to take the camcorder into the theater and record this and throw it up on BitTorrent because it's in 3D? Am I correct in saying that?
Yes, you are correct in saying that. It changes things a little bit. You know, it's not going to be the same experience.
Okay.
3D was actually sort of one of the themes of NAB back in April, National Association of Broadcasters Convention in Las Vegas. I don't think anybody was really there yet, and certainly 3D technology is something that's been on display for some time, but I saw some really, truly amazing displays from a lot of Japanese research firms. I hope I get it right. I believe it was NHK and NICT, which are kind of more research consortiums or the research arms of NHK, which is a Japanese broadcaster. And actually, I think it's a terrific application for sports. I'm not a huge fan of watching movies in 3D. Doesn't really do it for me personally. But I think that that the sports application is really fantastic. To be able to see, you know, a baseball game both in high def and in 3D is a pretty amazing experience. But there were also some innovations where I think the key for 3D working is it should be 3D without glasses. And that's what some of these Japanese companies introduced, is nobody wants to wear the 3D glasses. I mean, that's just such a turnoff point if you're going to the movies, I think. And a lot of these firms were looking at, okay, now you can do it without glasses, because that's kind of recognized as the next generation. But there's going to be sort of another big stumbling block to adoption. Let's say, you know, that there are a new set of televisions that are available that can handle this type of viewing, and, you know, people have the necessary equipment and technology in place. Well, you know, we've just spent the last 5 years and the last 5 months prepping for the digital transition, and now there'll be another one to deal with. So, but then again, hey, that's sort of been the history of TV and of technology and everything, is there's always innovation, there's always changes, and you have to swap out old equipment for new ones, be it CDs, for you know, for digital music, and videotapes for DVDs and whatnot. So it sort of be interesting to see how 3D takes off. Hey, I have a question for you guys, and this comes courtesy of my husband, who, as you guys know, is a videographer and a video producer. What's the deal with the battery life on the MacBook? He says it sucks. For you Mac users there, and Colleen, hey, you can feel free to weigh in, except you're a PC user. That's why I love you, because you're a PC girl. David, Tim, I don't know what you use, Brady, so if you feel free to weigh in, but it's advertised as an 8-hour battery, and you get about 2 hours. Thoughts, anyone? Bueller?
That's horrible. I would probably take my battery back and get it replaced, because maybe it's less of a universal problem. Maybe it's specific to his battery. Has he had it for a while, or is it brand new?
Yeah, he's already had the battery replaced, but I don't think it's unique to the computer. I think that there are a lot. I've sort of noticed. My husband has shown me a number of complaints on various Mac forums that this isn't the 6 to 8 hour battery that was promised. David, Tim, what kind of battery life are you getting out of your computer? Is it better than 2.5 hours? Do you have MacBooks?
Go ahead, Tim.
I've got a MacBook Pro, and the battery life's on it is probably in that 2.5 hour range. But I've got a Mac, so I'm happy. I don't care.
So yeah. You just accept it. You accept that it's part of it. David, what kind of battery life do you get?
I'm about the same as Tim. I have a MacBook Pro. I think on the smaller MacBooks, you might do a little better than that. But I'll probably take 30 minutes of battery life over a PC any day.
Oh, man, I got to tell you, I am all for the long battery life. You're with me, Colleen, right? I've got 5 hours on my PC. You get that extend a battery, and you just like, man, you go to New York, and you're on a flight to New York, and I got to tell you how efficient I am on the flight to New York. I get 2 or 3 stories written. I read about 30% of a book on my Kindle, because, of course, you have no idea how many pages you're reading on a Kindle. And I watch an episode or two of True Blood, and that's thanks to the PC people.
I will say this. He should really look at his settings. Because there are battery saver settings. There's, optimal screen performance settings. If you tweak those and play with those a little bit, you can usually get an extra 30 minutes to an hour out of your battery just by playing with that a little bit.
Just reminds me of that Mac Wheel video from The Onion. And it's the Hummingbird battery with 19 minutes of battery life. Hey, what are our thoughts on the new iPhone now that it's here? Does anyone have the new iPhone?
No.
I have the new operating system, but not the new iPhone yet.
what are your thoughts on kind of what Brady, what you've been reading about it, what you're hearing about it from people who have it? I'm kind of getting the impression that it's not a huge leap from the previous generation. Are we sort of talking about incremental change?
Yeah, absolutely. I went down to the Apple store over the weekend to kind of hold one. I'm a huge Apple geek, but what really is fascinating to me is that Apple didn't change the form factor at all. And one thing that drives upgrades, hardware upgrades, is new stylings, because you can actually differentiate on that basis. So the fact that the old, the iPhone 3G and iPhone 3GS look precisely the same from the outside, I think was a very interesting choice on Apple's part, and I think it actually leads me to believe that there will be in a rather short amount of time a significant upgrade or a new model that will be launched, because the changes aren't significant. They obviously added a compass, and there are some other hardware changes, including support for advanced 3G, next generation 3G. But the problem is AT&T's 3G network just doesn't cut it, and it won't really be upgraded until 2012. So that being said, obviously we all want kind of the newest, coolest gadgets. But for me, the upgrade of the operating system was really good enough. I'm not convinced that I will be needing to shoot a lot of video on my iPhone. I have a Kodak Zi6, and that seems to do it really well for me. So we'll see, though. Who knows? In a month, I may have serious iPhone envy.
You make cave, you Apple fanboy.
I'll say this, a couple of things, and I agree with you. I think that this may be an interim phase till the next thing comes out. I'm not going to buy the next one till they have video with HD in it. I've got my little Flip, and a lot of people, the general public, like that. I think once you have some HD video built in, and you can record an hour maybe of good HD video at, heck, even 720, I think it would be phenomenal.
David. Plant your flag and just say, I'm pushing back on you, Apple.
Yeah, and then the other thing, though, I don't know if you saw, but they've already sold 1 million of them, of the,
yeah,
the 3GSs.
Wild.
Yeah.
Well, wait. What's really interesting, to tie this back to the conversation we were just having on batteries, the iPhone actually does support 720p, and Apple made a decision to go the VGA route, most likely because of battery issues. So that if they were recording in full HD and editing in full HD, in 720 rather, it was going to decrease battery life substantially. But the 3 megapixel camera will shoot 720.
Okay,
you know,
well,
the big loser in this story is AT&T. I mean, on Twitter, all weekend long, people were really upset. I mean, ever since the developers conference, I guess, people have been really upset that, you know, the phone can tether everywhere else in the world except for here in the United States because AT&T. And so there's a lot of rumors flying around that, you know, you'll be able to tether with AT&T, but it's going to cost you extra money.
It's ridiculous, isn't it?
Meaning that you can have Wi-Fi for your computer.
Yeah, and also I think the other thing too, Tim, that it's important is they're 3 months delayed on the MMS feature. You know, so you have both tethering and MMS, two sort of big feature announcements, and AT&T just dropped the ball. I mean, I got to believe that, you know, Apple's getting pretty fed up with sort of making excuses for AT&T.
I'm sure they are. What was really interesting is during the developers' keynote a couple of weeks ago, there was not a single AT&T representative in the house, and that's the first time that's happened, especially for an iPhone launch. The last two, they had tons of AT&T people there, had AT&T representatives on stage, and this time they had absolutely zero, which I think is pretty indicative of the way that Apple and AT&T's relationship is headed.
All right, let's talk about a company that I like now. Google. Although I don't know that I'm actually going to use this feature. But I think it's just kind of an interesting little story in TechCrunch about Google Labs is going to launch Flipper. And it's kind of like a visual way to read Google News. You sort of flip through it. Again, it's not something I see myself using because I'm pretty happy with Google News, but maybe we're all kind of moving towards needing more of a visual presentation. David, what do you think about Google Flipper? Is it the next thing from Google that'll fail to take off?
Well, you know, you sent me the link, and I couldn't get it to open. So I haven't had a chance to honestly play with it. I don't know if any of the other guys have.
Well, shame on me.
It would go to the site. It just nothing would load.
I wonder if it's just not up for sort of public viewing yet. If the story was more just something that the TechCrunch folks kind of heard about, but I don't know. Maybe there's not a demo available to see.
I always liked watching Flipper. That was good. You know, they'd always catch the bad guy, and you know, they were on the ocean. It was fun. I liked Flipper.
So there you go.
Daisy, I think it's part of an increasing trend. Like if you look at Google Chrome or Safari 4. There's an Opera as well. There's a move towards these kind of visual launch pads as the default browser page. And so instead of typing a URL, you're literally just clicking on a thumbnail that represents a site. And that's kind of what Google Flipper is. I think it's really just a visual representation of your RSS feed. So whether or not it's, you know, a substantial change the way that we'll consume news. I don't think it is, because ultimately you're still just, you know, reading the news. But I think it will, for some people, make it a little bit more fun to browse through their feed.
Photo.
Yeah, whoa.
You know, I think we're going to need to find a way to get these photos that Colleen puts up. Colleen runs the board here at Leo's place, and she puts these fabulous photos up during the show. So for those of you who are watching live, you're getting to see them, and I hope getting a kick out of it. We're going to have to figure out a way how to have, you know, picture annotations on the podcast, because she just had this picture of a very, very sexy woman next to a dolphin. So there you go. You know, I've been using Google Chrome a lot more. Had some problems with Firefox, and I like that it's sort of very stripped down and simple to use. And this might be a dumb question, but hey, I'm not afraid to ask it. Is there a find feature in Google Chrome? Because one of the things I liked about Mozilla is if you were on a site and you were just looking for a particular word, I can't find that on Google Chrome. Control F. But can
sure
you set it
sure
so
is,
it's on the, like in a pull-down menu or anything? Yeah, whatever. Okay, fine. Control F. Control F, people, will save my life. Now I can finally find things and I don't ever have to go back to Mozilla. What do you guys use for browsers? Well, you're all Mac people, so you're using Safari?
Safari and Firefox.
Firefox, Opera, Camino.
Yeah, I usually have Firefox, Camino, Safari open. I have three instances open because typically when I have like 80 million windows open, my computer slows down, so I try to spread it out amongst a couple different browsers. I don't know if that actually works or just makes me feel better, but it seems to.
Admit it, David.
Well,
you love Internet Explorer, don't you?
Oh my God, Internet Explorer. So pathetic. It just needs to go away.
I know. I tried using it when I had some trouble with Mozilla a few weeks ago, and it was not good for uploading my videos. And my web developer emailed me, goes, "Don't ever use Internet Explorer again. Use Chrome." I'm like, okay, I'll start. I'll use Chrome. And actually, I don't know. This could just be a perception thing, but I felt as if the videos uploaded faster on Chrome. Maybe it was just because I didn't have any B-roll.
No. IE is definitively slow. Definitively slow.
Yeah, no. Colleen points. They probably won't affect the upload. So,
hey, Daisy, did you check out Bing at all? Did you play with Bing?
I did not.
Okay, because Bing was kind of a big story these last couple of weeks as well. The one thing I noticed about Bing was when I went to Microsoft Video and started exploring video at Microsoft site that used to say Microsoft, it now said Bing. And the news was that Bing took over as the number two. They beat out Yahoo in terms of traffic. And I was wondering if that's because Microsoft gave up some of their traffic to Bing.
And you know, Tim, even though I haven't personally checked it out, it seems to be getting good buzz. People who are using it seem to like it. So I don't know. I'd be curious if for those of our listeners who have checked it out, you know, as always, I love to kind of solicit your feedback. Email me, reply on Twitter. Let me know what you think about it. But yeah, that's a good point, Tim. And I don't know the answer to that, but happy to look it up. Hey, I have a TV story I want to discuss very briefly. Letterman, David Letterman, that is.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty strong in the ratings. And yeah, that could be obviously because we had the changing of the guard, I believe, on was it June 1st or June 6th? I'm not certain, but just a couple weeks ago when Conan took over for Jay Leno. So you would sort of naturally expect that there might be a small drop off or a large drop off for that matter. Jay Leno obviously had a lot of loyal fans. But then I wonder how much of the surge in ratings was due to the sort of very bad Sarah Palin daughter joke that Letterman told. So I think we have a couple things, and again, it goes back to with all marketing questions, sort of how to separate what was the impetus for success. Tim, what are your thoughts? Does Letterman have sort of a chance right now to really surge ahead and become, on an ongoing basis, the number one late night talk show guy? And how much of it is because of controversy and NBC Suites dropping its ads because of the joke, even though he apologized for it?
Yeah, I don't know the research behind it. I mean, my gut feeling is that it was a perfect storm. It was everything that you just said. Having Sarah Palin fuel the fire just got him more and more ratings. It'll be interesting to see how he does moving forward. I mean, I don't think he meant the joke in a malicious way. I think, you know, it was something they came up with in the writer's room and just went with it. And then it became a story. And that got more ratings.
Although there are some advertisers, like Olive Garden has pulled their ads from Letterman because of the joke. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of fallout occurs on that side of things.
Brady, what sort of buzz is this getting online? I mean, that's obviously the area that you track pretty closely. Were the video clips of the joke circulating? And also, just to the broader point, is there kind of a lot of online chatter about, you just have to stop it, Colleen.
She's
putting up all these pictures and making me crazy.
Is there
sort of a lot of online chatter about how Conan is doing in general and how Letterman is doing and who's going to be the late night king, or if it will be a, what do you call it, a duopoly?
Yeah, duopoly, I think that's the right word. Yeah, absolutely. I think anytime you have a story like this, especially, you know, with the proliferation of a million pirated videos on YouTube, it tends to pick up steam, and it tends to kind of create this little mini echo chamber where the story becomes very important very quickly, you know, on the Twitter sphere and specifically on YouTube too. And YouTube's trying to pull down, but you know, responding to DMCA notices as fast as they can, and fans are posting videos as fast as they can. So because of that, I think it creates like a certain immediacy to the story. And you know, these kind of clips are wonderful, you know, fodder for you know, email forwards. And that really, to me, I mean, that's still one of the primary ways that I include into YouTube videos is someone will email me something, which is odd seeing as how I spend all of my time on Twitter, but it's still, it's the way it works.
Maybe, well, see, maybe you value email as a communications channel more than Twitter, which kind of goes back to one of our earlier stories. Tim, go ahead.
In Hollywood, the big talk about late night television is Jay moving to five nights a week at the 10 o'clock hour. That kills a lot of original scripted programming, saves NBC a ton of money, and a lot of writers, a lot of executive producers are really worried that they may be out of work if Leno succeeds in that 10 o'clock spot.
And I've got to believe he's going to succeed. I mean, even if he doesn't bring the kind of ratings that the other shows do, his show is still so much less expensive to produce.
Yeah, it's
absolutely
definitely in a transitional time.
I have a final topic for today, and it's a listener question. I always like to solicit listener questions and topics for TWIM. And this is from Rich A. Still. Hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly. He says, can we talk about podcasters adding more commercials and company mentions, people? He says they are losing that homegrown feeling, lack of better term, selling out. Of course, I say, yeah, that's how we pay our bills. But this is kind of it's an interesting point. It's sort of that age-old push-pull. Artists becoming successful, and then are they selling out because they're suddenly successful and they're no longer indie or whatever? If a podcast or a web show or whatever, it gets gets more commercials, then you can kind of get some listener pushback. But at the same time, we gotta pay the bills. I know that I got just a tad bit of pushback. I have two sponsors now for the New Media Minute, and I didn't get too much pushback on it, but a couple of people wrote and said, okay, now you're full of ads. And I'm thinking, well, this is how I can continue to do it. This is how I pay the bills and can bring news and reporting. Do you guys feel that there is, how do you find that fine balance? I mean, Brady, you cover a lot of these web shows. This is not just a podcast issue, but you cover a lot of these web shows. How do web hosts, web producers kind of deal with striking that fine balance?
I think it's a really interesting case because we're all very used to advertising online. Every blog you go to, every news site has tons of display advertising, whether sponsorship or CPM based. But as soon as advertising starts to interfere with our entertainment experiences, i.e. pre-roll or interstitial or post-roll, there tends to be a bit of a lash back. What I think is very interesting, though, is that we're very much trained to accept advertising as a payment method on television. But I think there's this overriding sense that online content is somehow exempt from that, and because it's more homegrown and more community-oriented, that commercialization is bad. But like you said, everyone has to pay their bills, and if content creators are going to continue to create content, they need to be compensated, and they can do that one of two ways. They can either charge the viewers, or they can bring on advertisers, and I think both of those are fine models. And it depends really largely on the audience that you cater to, which one will work the best, and which one isn't going to cause you to lose credibility with your audience.
And I don't know that there's ever going to be a place where listeners, viewers are totally happy. I think in some great nirvana, when we all move on to the next life, everything will be free and that'll be fabulous and we'll all want for nothing and blah, 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 blah. But, for now we live in the real world. And as you say, we have to pay bills. But I think that there's always going to be a little bit of friction between fans and creators over that. And yeah, I think that's just the way it goes. Theater, live theater counts as media, right?
Absolutely.
No, Colleen says no. Can I just say, I saw enough from you. I'm going to smack you after the show, girl. Okay, so I was in New York last week.
I think live theater counts if you're Twittering from the audience.
Yes, yeah, I
there
did.
We go. That's it.
Okay, so yep. It counts. All right, people, so it counts. Can I just say, I saw the best Broadway show last week when I was in New York, Billy Elliot. So good. So good. Any of you who are going to New York, traveling to New York, whenever it goes on tour, it is just a little wonderful, joyful 2.5 hours in the theater. So I just have to say that. I have to tell you that. Oh, and wait, I have to tell you about a movie that I really, really enjoyed that was really kind of dumb. And you all know I kind of like dumb, stupid guy humor. So my husband and I watched Fired Up a couple weeks ago. Yeah, it's weird. A lot of the movies I like have about 20% ratings on Rotten Tomatoes, but I don't care. I like what I like. I thought it was really, really funny. It's about these two high school teenage boys who are football players. And of course, they want to get as many girls as possible. They go to cheerleading camp. I don't know. I just thought it was really funny. So I'm going to give you my recommendations. My highbrow, Billy Elliot, and my lowbrow, Fired Up recommendations. Speaking of recommendations, I want to solicit our listeners, as I like to do. I am putting together a, this is for my book blog, bookchick.com. I'm putting together a must-read summer reading list in various categories. As you probably know, I read a lot of young adult, I read a lot of women's fiction. I don't read a lot of nonfiction, but I'm all about the community. And just because I'm not reading it doesn't mean I can't share it. So I'm going to come up with sort of a 10 must-read nonfiction books that have come out in, either this year or last year. So I'm going to ask listeners to help me out and give me their suggestions. I don't need long descriptions of them, but just kind of a quick, why you like it, it's the best in this category or whatever, and then I'll kind of compile it together into a post and give everybody who gave me submissions credit for it. Just it'll be sort of a group thing. As always, I invite your blend tech ideas. We like to blend tech your business every few episodes. David has helped me with that, Alex does it, Brian Brushwood a couple weeks ago, Tim and other folks have been great at if you've got a business or whatever it is, a podcast, a project. We are of the belief that anything can have effective video marketing behind it, a la the blend tech model. So we will blend tech your business. You can always send those suggestions to me. And let's just go around the horn. Tim, where can people find you?
They can find me at my blog, onetimstreet.com.
That's easy. Brady, where do you want people to find you?
Twitter.com/BradyBD.
BradyBD.tv. Okay, so that's twitter.com/Brady, B as in boy, D as in dog. David, where do you want people to find you?
DavidRewalt.com. I just switched my hosting over to Squarespace, I'm proud to say.
I hear great things about Squarespace.
It's pretty awesome. Pretty awesome.
Everybody seems to like it. They're one of our regular sponsors, so I'm sure we'll have a plug for them in a future episode. And as always, you can find me at daisywhitney.com, and you can find my reports on BeatTV, BEET.TV, TubeFilter.TV, various other places. And I will be back. And thank you all for tuning in. Farewell.